Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, a conversation with Dodgers legend Steve Garvey, the Senate candidate for the Republicans in California, hasn't done a whole lot publicly since he advanced March 5th in this Senate competition. But he did make a big deal this week about what was happening on the campuses of USC and UCLA and other campuses across the country, staking out a pretty pro-Israel position. He came to Beverly Hills to speak in front of the 1,000-plus flags that are set up there to represent the Israelis killed by Hamas on October 7th, with a pretty clear message about what's happening in terms of the protests. In a moment, we'll talk with Jessica Levinson and get some legal analysis if sort of what Garvey is saying could actually happen. But first, let's hear from Steve Garvey, one-on-one with me. Steve Garvey, great to see you again.
You too.
What is your main message about what's happening on college campuses right now?
Well, I think that people aren't using the word terror strong enough. I mean, this is a terrorism that's hiding behind free speech. And if we allow it to this movement to keep going day after day, you know, we saw the East Coast and the Ivy Leagues, and now it's come to the West Coast, and it's close, it's personal, it's SC, and now UCLA, and it's going to be other colleges. Let's treat it for what it is.
Obviously, freedom of speech is the First Amendment.
Absolutely.
How do you balance that? Where is the line?
Well, the line is what I was talking about today. You know, the political courage for leaders to step up, like I did today, and say, you can't infringe on individuals and their religious belief. I mean, this country was created on free speech, but responsible free speech. When you put encampments on colleges that force kids not to be able to go to class, and now they have to, Jewish students, to leave the campus and to do work online, that's not the mission statement of these great universities. And I challenge the leadership to get back to the fundamentals.
I know you've been frustrated by L.A. County D.A. George Gascon.
I challenge the D.A. to step up and try these cases of terrorism to the full extent of the law. I challenge my opponent, Adam Schiff, stand up with me for Israel, but against those terrorists, pro-Hamas students and individuals. If you support terrorism, you become a terrorist. So let's step up. Voice our opinion about it, but it's Mr. Gascon that you really have to set an example for the city, state, and the country on how you treat these people.
I mean, what charges would you like to see Gascon bring forward to the folks that are protesting who say they're exercising their free First Amendment rights?
Well, whatever charges that apply, I mean, he'll know what they are. Execute them. It's political courage.
You said that you would, as a senator, bring these college presidents to Washington. I imagine you would have an opportunity to question them. What would be your main question that you would ask them if you got them under oath in front of one of your committees?
What is your responsibility to the institution students? Why have you forsaken that responsibility by allowing fear, physical, mental, and spiritual harm to these students? It's unconscionable. And if you can't answer that, just as a lot of presidents of Ivy League schools have, well, then we're going to have to do something about it. The federal aid you're being given is for the protection of the students. Maybe if we take that away, you'll all of a sudden realize what true leadership is.
This is the first time we've seen you since you advanced. Congratulations, by the way. Very impressive showing.
You helped launch me.
Steve Garvey, are you running for U.S. Senate?
Well, it's been the worst kept secret, I think.
What does the next few months look like? What does this campaign look like from here?
Well, it's a full-out sprint over the next 7 months. It sounds like a marathon, but we've come so far. And if you look at the primary election, look at how we finished within, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 votes of each other, with 4.5 million votes cast, 300,000 advantage in the temporary seat. I had more votes than all the Republican presidential candidates combined. So all those things tell you and I that the people are listening, they're standing up, they're saying they believe in me, they believe in days like today where they can see the leadership that they knew was there.
And lastly, on a fun note, it's the first time I've seen you since the Dodgers have started playing this year.
That's
what do
right.
you think?
Well, the top four guys are hitting, 1,000? The bottom four are hitting 100. But, you know, it's a start. We never can evaluate a team until June. They're bringing up a lot of guys to give them experience. They'll be there in October. The question is if they can get through the first round of the playoffs.
Yeah.
Our thanks to Steve Garvey. Now, a conversation with Jessica Levinson. With us now to offer legal analysis and maybe some baseball analysis too is Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School on campus right now. Welcome back to The Issue Is.
I was the only girl on my Little League team, but I think we're out of my depth on that one.
Okay, so we'll leave the baseball stuff to Garvey, but I will ask you about the legal stuff. Garvey calling the protesters terrorists that should be prosecuted. Is there an actual legal case there? Because that word, terrorism, terrorist, is a legal word, too.
There's not. There's a political argument that he's making. But if you look at any statute, if you look at any code that mentions terrorism, this is not what we're looking at here. Now, he can certainly say there are reasons for removing protesters if, for instance, they become violent. But this does not amount to terrorism in any legal definition.
What sort of legal rights do these folks have? Because we've seen different approaches at different places. For example, USC, private school with gates. They're basically closing down the campus. UCLA, public school without gates, basically letting these folks camp out. Are there rights for them?
There are. So even when it comes to private universities in California, as you know, there's a state law which tries to match the First Amendment when it comes to private colleges and universities and First Amendment rights. Very briefly, I think what we need to think about when we think about the protesters and their rights is that you don't want a school to target based on either the identity of the speaker or the content of the speech, because that starts to look like a censorship that we get worried about. Now, if a school is saying we can't conduct classes, we can't function, we can't keep other students safe, those are all reasons separate and apart from we don't like what you're saying or who you are. And so that's really the balance that we're trying to look at here. For the protesters, again, they really need to be treated the same way regardless of what they're saying. If somebody is causing a hindrance to the school's ability to function or keep their students safe, then that can be remedied. Again, you just have to be careful about targeting the substance of the speech or the identity of the speaker.
I mean, do protesters have a right to essentially camp out in the middle of campus and create their own tent city?
So the answer is it depends a little bit. It depends on the campus. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on what they're doing. I know everybody hates this answer from an attorney where you say, well, it depends on the context and the circumstances. But peaceful protests is a celebrated tradition in our country.
All right. So let's talk about another huge legal story this week. Trump's trial for alleged hush money payments to cover up his alleged affair with Stormy Daniels. That trial now underway. For people that aren't following it that closely, what is the most important thing that we need to know about it?
So the most important thing we need to know, I think, is, again, what it is. This is the allegation is that the former president falsified business records, that he said that he was paying his former fixer, Michael Cohen, attorney's fees, but he was actually reimbursing him for hush money payments, and that he falsified those business records, saying it was attorney's fees, in order to try and commit another crime, which is campaign finance violations. And so the second most important thing, I think, is that the prosecution's case is moving fairly quickly. And the first witness is David Pecker, who led the National Enquirer and the parent company of the National Enquirer. And what he has done for the prosecution is put the former president at the center of this alleged hush money scheme and said that he knew what was going on and that this was about trying to affect the election. That, Alex, as you know, is key to this case, that it's key for the prosecution to show the payments were made to affect the election, because that's the only way you get the allegations related to campaign finance fraud.
And basically, David Pecker saying that there was this elaborate scheme that went on for months between him and Trump to not only catch and kill stories, make stories go away that may be true, but to fabricate stories as well that weren't true about Trump's opponents. But in terms of this actual charge, has this sort of thing ever been a felony before?
So certainly it is the case that New York has used this falsification of business records law and bumped it up. It's typically a misdemeanor. They've bumped it up to a felony if you can show that you falsified the business records in order to commit or conceal another crime. Now, is this the most common type of allegation in New York? No. The common type is the misdemeanor falsification of business records. But it's also the case that you can, again, use the statute for that purpose. You can move it up to a felony, but there's more work for the prosecution. They have to show that Trump intended, that's going to be key for them, intended to commit or conceal another crime.
And this isn't the only thing that Trump is dealing with when it comes to legal matters this week. His case was at the Supreme Court of the United States over this issue of presidential immunity. Essentially, can the president do whatever he wants because he's the president? You listen to these arguments. What was your takeaway? Where do you think the justices are leaning?
I think they're all leaning to some sort of middle ground. So as you said, the question is whether or not, it's actually not just Trump, it's any former president. What kind of immunity do you enjoy from criminal prosecution based on official acts? The oral arguments took about 2.5 hours. The justices explicitly said, this isn't just about Trump. We're making a decision for every president and every future ex-president. And we're trying to determine what type of protection does the Constitution entitle them to. I would be extremely surprised if the court says there's absolute protection. I would be very surprised if the court says there's no protection. What they're doing is they're kind of dancing in this middle ground. They're going to try and craft some sort of rule that says, when it comes to those official acts, maybe things that only the president can do under the Constitution, there will be some immunity. But when it comes to private acts and maybe other types of official acts, maybe that's where it gets more complicated and there is, in fact, no immunity because of that principle. No person is above the law.
So if they did what you just said, then they would be possible for Trump to be tried for what happened on January 6th from a federal basis. But is that likely? What is the chance we're actually going to see a Trump trial regarding January 6th before the November elections?
I think there is not that chance, to be honest, because what we're looking at here is we had oral arguments the last week of April before the court. This is a complicated case. I mean, we could go step by step through what the court is struggling with, but I think it's going to take them a while to write this opinion. Alex, you know, if you want to talk about it again when the opinion comes out, I think it will be the last week of June. At that point, my guess is it goes back to the trial court judge, Judge Chutkan, who's overseeing that federal DC interference trial. She's going to then have to apply the new standard, figure out which of the allegations can be included, which, if any, of the allegations cannot be included where there is immunity. And then if somebody doesn't like her decision, it goes back up to the DC circuit, at which point I just don't see a trial before November.
And in that case, essentially, Trump wins, even without a trial, because he's run out the clock, depending on, of course, if he wins the election or not. Jessica Levinson, a reminder of why this election is so important. In so many different ways, the stakes are so high. And on a personal note, I just want to say, when you started with us on this show 6 years ago, I know you were trying to get more into the TV world, and it has been incredible to see your growth. You're on basically every single TV network every single day, the most famous Zoom background in America. Congratulations on all your success. You're doing such a great job, and we're proud of you.
Well, I'm honored. I think this is actually our sixth anniversary of my first appearance, fifth or sixth, but I'm so happy to be asked back.
All right, Jessica, thank you so much. And I think there'll be more to talk about in the weeks and months ahead. Our thanks to Jessica, our thanks to Steve Garvey, and our thanks to you for listening. This week, we have another podcast we put out, which is our full conversation with Harvey Levin, which was really interesting about a variety of topics, and I hope you'll check that out as well. Next week, we expect to have Bill Maher on the show, which we're very, very, very excited about. I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.